And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're swilling our way into spring here in the Northern Hemisphere. It's time for life to emerge, and it does. The nights show off their new constellations, while seeds splash out in celebration. Bears come out of hibernation. College students sick of too much education. Politicians vie for final confirmation as we all go down from economic strangulation. As the price of gas keeps rising at the neighborhood gas station, Congress keeps on asking about those covert operations, but only seems to come up with more endless frustrations. And that's why it's time to tune into the station as the Wild Side News sends to you this invitation. Spring's coming. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
At exactly 5:48 Greenwich Mean Time on March 20th, 2008, every living thing everywhere on this earth will be in balance with exactly half the day in light and half the day in darkness. It's that official beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. It's amazing how many cultures around the world were able to mark this day exactly. The Mayan and Aztec cultures built their temples to confirm it. At Chaco Canyon, on the top of a monumental rock mass, Chacoans marked the day with a sun dagger piercing through a spiral. It makes me wonder if these ancients didn't think of this more as the beginning of the year. And it makes me wonder how our lives would be different if we marked spring as the beginning of the year, where everything begins in balance. Summer and winter are extremes, hot and cold. The center point seems a better place to begin. Spring is an Earth celebration, unique to us. And just as we have fooled ourselves for all time referring to a sunrise, when it really is an Earth turn, so too we think the Earth turns towards the sun. Actually, the Earth just goes round and round and round and round. And we seem to lean into our journey around the sun, and that lean means that sometimes that fixed lean leans away from the sun in winter, and then 6 months later, on the other side of the sun, so to speak, it's leaning towards the sun, as in summer. Nothing wobbling back and forth. If we did, the North Star would be going round and round in circles. Today we're going to learn how you can get synced up with spring in just 10 minutes. That's coming up in the weekly Earth Summit in just a few moments. And in segment two, it's time again for the Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital. And this year, they're focusing on water. We'll be talking with David Douglas, the president of Water Advocates, who will be sharing the critical need to address drinking water issues around the world as World Water Day approaches this Saturday. It's a great show coming up. So now it's time to get things going with the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith. It's a good thing to get synced up. Everything works better when things are in sync. So today I'm going to tell you how you can get in sync with spring in just 10 minutes. And because I know how busy we all are these days, I'm going to make this especially easy because it will take just 1 minute at a time. It couldn't be easier than that. But I guarantee, if you just take 10 single minutes, you'll get yourself in alignment with this planet and the season. And what's easy is you don't have to do them all at once. As a matter of fact, it's better if you spread them out throughout a week. And maybe you'll find that if you make it a habit to repeat these 10 one-minute exercises every week, it will keep you synced up even more through time. So here are the 10-minute exercises of spring. The one caveat here is that during each of these minutes, this has to be your entire focus. Okay. So here goes. Minute 1. For 1 minute, just watch the clouds. Sometime in the next week, when you're outside, spend just 1 minute watching clouds. Minute 2. Whether you're indoors or outdoors, spend 1 minute touching a plant. Focus your attention on a plant. Feel its leaves. Touch its stem. Feel how it feels to just run your hands up the plant. Say something nice to the plant. Minute 3. Take a container of water outdoors and spend 1 minute gently watering a plant that you think would like a drink of fresh water. Create a little moat around the stem of the plant and slowly pour the water in, letting it seep down into the ground. Minute 4. Sometime when you're outside, stop whatever you're doing and just listen. Try to hear the life around you. Try to make out every bird call. Listen to leaves rustling in the wind. Try to extend your hearing so that you can hear to the edges of your yard, out into your neighborhood, out into your town or city. Hear the world in spring. Minute 5. While you're taking a shower, get things started and then spend just 1 minute with the shower off. You can just lather up, rub your head, clean your body, even take a few deep breaths. You'll be taking the first steps at helping to deal with the shortages of water it seems we're all heading for. Then go ahead and continue showering. Minute 6. Sometime this week, go ahead and head outside at night and just stare up at the universe and wonder for just a minute. Think whatever comes into your mind, and be sure to take a moment to put this earth into the middle of the infinite. Minute 7. Take 1 minute to secretly feed an animal. What's that mean? Take something edible, a small piece of bread, an uncooked pea, a leaf of spinach, a piece of raw meat, whatever it is, and go outside. Now find a secret place where you'd expect animals to traverse and secretly put your treat there, and then go away. Next day, see what's happened. If nothing has, then try it again somewhere else. Eventually you'll find a place where some animal delights in its newfound treasure. Minute 8. Sometime during the week, take 1 minute to tell a friend or even an acquaintance about one of the things you've done this week as part of your 10-minute spring exercises. Choose any of them and just work it into a conversation. Open up a conversation about animals, plants, and the earth. Minute 9. Sometime this week, go outside and tell the earth how thankful you are for all that it provides, and ask the earth to help you understand how you can help it through these difficult times. Somehow the earth listens, and the earth speaks. Be open to hear what it will share with you in the days ahead. And finally, minute 10. Take 1 minute to write a secret note about the earth. Just 1 minute. Put it on a piece of paper, or write it with chalk on a sidewalk, or in the dirt on a car window, or in an email to a friend. Write a secret message about the earth and spread the word. I guarantee every one of you, if you take just these 10 minutes, giving each minute your fullest, deepest attention, you and the world will become closer friends. And for any of you who can find the time, besides these 10 minutes, send me an email about anything that happened as a result of your 10-minute spring sync. Send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. And remember that we meet here every week during the first segment of the Wild Side News. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us there for each week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth, on the weekly Earth Summit. And now a brief look at this week's Nature News. So now the news. Nature is full of surprises, and the newest reports on winter precipitation are like a terrific present. With the coolest winter since 2001 here in the U.S. and around the globe, a significant increase in moisture and therefore snowpack occurred over this last winter along the West Coast. This is good news for those who have been warning of the potentials for water shortages due to global warming. The record coolest winter, however, was actually balanced off by a generally warmer winter in the eastern half of the nation, which also brought good news to those whose heating bills rise and fall with the winter temperatures. Mountain snowpack exceeded 150% of average in large parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Oregon. This should prove beneficial to these drought-plagued areas. Around the world, glaciers are on the run, shrinking and retreating at an accelerating rate. 30 of the world's largest glaciers, with long historic record-keeping, indicate that the rate of melting is averaging just about 5 feet per year. At this rate, many of the world's glaciers will be gone within a couple of decades. This will have dramatic impact on people which rely on glacial waters, particularly in areas like India, which rely on the Himalayan glaciers for much of their water. The western U.S. also relies on glacial meltwaters to a large degree. Whoops, looks like there's been a little fussing of the lines at the EPA. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is holding hearings on apparent conflicts of interest as advisors to the EPA were, in certain cases, actually employed by the companies which manufactured the chemicals and agents that they were reporting on. Among the appointments questioned, an employee of ExxonMobil Corporation who served on an expert panel assessing the cancer-causing potential of ethylene oxide, a chemical produced by ExxonMobil. A participant on a panel assessing the risk to humans from a commonly used octane enhancer who was employed by an engineering company that worked with the makers of the chemical and major oil and chemical companies. Whoops. A scientist who served on a panel examining the health impacts of ethylene oxide, again, a component in various industrial chemicals, who received research support from Dow Agro, one of the chemicals manufacturers. The examples by the House Committee were part of a report last month by the Environmental Working Group, a Washington-based advocacy group that said its investigation found that among 7 external EPA review panels, 17 reviewers showed potential conflicts of interest. Dolphins give a damn about other animals, or at least that's the conclusion of many who witnessed a most amazing show of compassion by Moco, the bottlenose dolphin. Moco is a friendly dolphin that likes to hang out with humans at a New Zealand beach. But Moco pushed her way past humans trying to help reorient a mother's sperm whale and her calf, which had lost their sense of direction and had succeeded in restranding themselves 4 times, that is, until Moco came to the rescue. Moco approached the sperm whales and then led them the 200 yards it took to find passage back to the sea. There are many stories of dolphins coming to the aid of humans, but their zeal for altruistic action is now reaching out to animals that require assistance. Thank you. We need all the help we can get right now. And that's the news. If you have any news tips, please send them here to the Wildside News. You can send an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. I'll repeat that, wildsidenews@cox.net. In just a moment, we're heading to the nation's capital to talk about water, the topic of discussion at the 16th Annual Environmental Film Fest, happening right now. You'll hear about that and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Okay. Strolling along in Central Park, everyone's out today. The daisies and dogwoods are all in bloom. Oh, what a glorious day for picnics and frisbees and roller skaters, friends and lovers and lonely sunbathers. Everyone's out in merry Manhattan in January. brought the iced tea? Did you bring the bug spray? The flies are the size of your head. Next to the palm tree, did you see the gators looking happy and well fed? Everyone's out and merry, Manhattan in January. My preacher said, don't you worry, the scientists have it all wrong. And so who cares, it's winter here, and I have my halter top on. I have my halter top on. Everyone's out and merry, Manhattan in Jan.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The old saw, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink, is a challenge many of the world's people face each day. As the specter of global warming creates visions of drying lands and shrinking glaciers, at the same time that population is increasing, particularly in the developing worlds, this issue will become one of the great environmental and cultural struggles of this century. World Water Day, scheduled for March 22nd, will bring attention to the issue. The annual Environmental Film Festival focuses its lens on this issue on the final day of its 16-year run. We're off to the nation's capital when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. For the past 16 years, the world's greatest videographers, documentarians, and filmmakers gather in the nation's capital for the Environmental Film Festival. This is where the world's finest nature filmmakers showcase their work. Many of the films premiere and go on to become legacy pieces in the nature genre. This year, the legendary naturalist E.O. Wilson will be attending the premiere of Darwin's Natural Air, a film profiling his life and pioneering work. Director George Butler's latest film, The Lord God Bird, about the search for the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, will also be screened. In total, 115 documentary, feature, animated, archival, experimental, and children's films will be showcased during this year's event, which actually began last week and continues on through the weekend of March 22nd. 46 venues throughout the nation's capital will be participating in the festival, and most of the screenings are free and open to the public, and many feature discussions with the filmmakers and scientists as well. This year's event highlights the topic of water as part of the World Water Day tribute. On March 22nd at 4 p.m. in the Carnegie Institution of Washington, a panel discussion on global water challenges will follow the screening of the year's best 8 films on water issues, and specifically drinking water. I talked recently with the moderator of that panel. One of the things that I recall very well, I was thinking about survival skills, and I found a little thing, the Universal Guide to Survival. And the thing that struck me when I read it was just a little tiny thing that fit in your pocket so you could always carry it with you, was that they prioritized survival needs. They said, first of all, you have to have clean air. You have to be able to breathe, because if you can't breathe for any short period of time, even minutes, you're probably going to die. Water was the second criteria, because without water, you start to go into collapse and can die within about 3 days. And then food, hey, you can go for a month. Many of us have enough body fat and things to keep us going. But this issue of water and the importance of it really struck me in terms of if you're thinking about surviving, you have to have water to drink. That's becoming a major issue around the world for a lot of people. It has been for a long time, but of course now with global warming, perhaps some of these issues are becoming even more challenging. And part of the Environmental Film Festival that's happening right now, actually, in Washington, D.C., we cover this each year. On March 22nd, they're going to be leading up to and focusing on World Water Day. One of the people who is really involved with that to a very high degree is David Douglas, who's now joining us from Washington, D.C. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Good to hear your voice, Sydney.
First of all, you're involved with an organization called Water Advocates. People can find that at wateradvocates.org. David, why don't you give us a little background on Water Advocates?
Yes. Water Advocates is an organization that's been around for the last 2.5 years, or 2005, and it's somewhat of an unusual organization in twofold. One, its mission is really just to be around till the end of 2010. It has a sunset clause, and it was really the first full-time advocacy organization on behalf of clean drinking water set up in Washington, D.C. I grew up in D.C., and there's no shortage of advocacy organizations on everything else under the sun. And incredibly, I was writing about this issue of international drinking water in the 1980s and urging that an advocacy organization be set up. I kept thinking that it would be done, and it never happened. And so a number of us stepped into the vacuum several years ago, and we're hoping by the end of our time in 2010 to have quantum leaped the issue to some extent on the radar screen of five particular constituencies that we're working with. We're focused specifically on not just on increasing awareness, but on increasing funding for safe, affordable, and sustainable supplies of drinking water and adequate sanitation. The five constituencies we're focused on are Congress and United States corporations, foundations, faith communities, and civic organizations.
In terms of funding, why don't we just start with that a little bit and talk about if people help with funding, how much does it take to make a difference in a community? And I know you're working around all over the world. You're helping around the world. Really, what does it take to make a difference?
Right. I should say in a preliminary way, Water Advocates is not looking for funding. We're fully funded through the end of 2010. And what we do when people ask where they can give, we point them towards a variety of ways to respond that I can go into later. And on our website, we have a partial list of the U.S.-based 501c3 nonprofit organizations that have been working in drinking water and sanitation for some time. So, again, it's somewhat an unusual situation in D.C. where we're not asking for funding for ourselves. In terms of how much funding makes a difference, the range is huge. I've headed a nonprofit in Santa Fe, New Mexico for over 20 years called Waterlines. We work with very small-scale drinking water projects in rural parts of developing countries. And there, every dollar makes a significant difference. The average water project for example, what is called as a gravity flow water system, where you protect a spring up in the mountains and bring it down by tubing down into a central part of the community and then have it radiate from there, can be as little as $5,000-$7,000. We've worked, for example, in Panama, in rural Panama, with over 50 gravity flow water systems with rural communities. And again, I should emphasize that the requests bubble up from the community themselves. It's oftentimes they've tried to get work funding for themselves through their government, have reached an impasse, and they've heard about us usually through word of mouth. But we've also worked with Peace Corps volunteers in Panama, for example. But there, $5,000-$7,000 makes a tremendous difference. In Kenya, we've worked to provide rainwater catchment tank. We're working in a part of the world where there's several monsoon seasons and rain seasons and that are enough to provide some clean drinking water there. An average 10,000-gallon tank at a school or a clinic costs about $2,000 or $2,500. In a larger case, in municipal areas around the world and peri-urban areas, you're seeing the need for tremendous higher levels of investment, and that gets to the heart of the problem and the reason why we really set up Water Advocates. There is a shortfall of funding in drinking water and sanitation internationally. In the United States, there's a shortfall of about $20 billion a year, and that is, as you can imagine, if there's that kind of a shortfall to keep our own excellent drinking water and wastewater systems up to speed, you can imagine in the developing world the amount of shortfall that's there. And at that point, it becomes imperative for Americans to realize that they have a variety of ways to responding. They can provide funding for small-scale projects, but they can also talk to their legislators to urge increased foreign aid funding on behalf of the United States government.
You know, an interesting aspect of your project here, you're talking about, for example, some of the gravity flow systems, is the way in which this affects individuals and how they live their lives, particularly in developing areas. I think I know that one of the campaigns that you've really focused on is the effect that just this process of getting water affects women and girls. I think that's just a really interesting dynamic of this.
So we're just coming off an event last Wednesday at the March 12th on the National Geographic Society Auditorium, where 350 people came together to focus on what's called WASH in schools. That acronym is Water and Sanitation Hygiene, WASH in schools. UNICEF and other nonprofits have been working in this area for years below the radar screen. What the event on March 12th was designed to do was to focus Americans' attention on the fact that one half of the world's schools in 2008 don't even have a basic latrine or access to clean drinking water, and the impact on the school children is enormous. The global public health problem, this is the diseases associated with drinking water, inadequate drinking water and sanitation, remains the world's most serious public health problem. It takes more lives and makes more people sick than HIV/AIDS, malaria, TB, and yet it's below the radar screen of most Americans, and it particularly affects, as you mentioned, young girls and women. Women are usually the water haulers. The average African woman going for water walks 6 kilometers per day. Young girls are staying out of school because they're having to haul water. If there's not an adequate latrine at the time they reach puberty for privacy during menstruation, some statistics out of Bangladesh show that they were 15% less likely to attend schools. Adolescent girls were dropping out. So global health problem is huge, but it also affects gender rights and education.
You're working on the scale of worldwide advocacy for drinking water. Are there certain areas of the world where this problem seems to be more prevalent than others?
Right. The worldwide totals, according to the latest statistics from UNICEF and the World Health Organization, indicate that worldwide, just looking at that for the minute, about 1.1 billion people do not have adequate drinking water per day. I think the total on inadequate sanitation is a number of 2.6 billion people. There are various ways of looking at it. In terms of total number of people, the greatest areas of inadequately served people would be China and India. If you're looking at the highest proportion of people, it would probably be certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But at the same time, Latin America has huge numbers, even though they're somewhat better off on the number area. There are huge problems in Latin America as well. And we first started working with our organization, Water Lines, in rural areas of Mexico and Peru and Bolivia. Overall, what we've tried to do with water advocates is to suggest a balanced approach, of particularly in the federal government, but also in potential donors that we talk to urge a balanced approach, not putting all the eggs in one basket of one specific geographical locale.
Let's go to an area like sub-Saharan Africa where there's a problem. You can't just make water happen. So what are alternatives? Perhaps the water supplies are disappearing. Many people, I suppose, rely on springs and or small ponds. If you're really running out of water in an area, what can you actually do?
Right, and I think the answer to that is it really gets back to the idea that there's different ways for everyone to respond, in part because there's no one solution. There's no one answer to the question.
It's very site-specific.
Exactly right. And the best way to answer that is in that certain locale, the local community, the local water community, working with hydrologists, working with the local NGOs or the municipalities, develop a plan that utilizes the existing water sources to the best available opportunity. It may involve, for example, protecting a spring. I mean, animals may be walking through and defecating in spring areas where people are going for their drinking water. So by protecting a building, a concrete structure that keeps animals at bay and helps to protect the water, that may be one source. And then you may need on top of that additional filtration to help or chlorination. Another way, very low cost, might be, as I mentioned before, in Kenya, where we were working to provide rainwater catchment tanks. But you need for that, of course, adequate roofs and adequate rainfall periodically throughout the year. Another way may be gravity flow systems that I mentioned. Another way may be deep water wells, but the drawback there is that even though it provides an excellent supply of water usually, is oftentimes the cost, and oftentimes the depth to water to reach the aquifer is prohibitively expensive, and it entails a cost on the community for the pumping of the well. So it's a wonderful, you know, opportunity, but it's, again, it doesn't come for free. But the key answer there is, unlike looking for a single silver bullet to solve a problem with, for example, the invention of a vaccine, the water, drinking water supply and sanitation problem is very scattered, very fragmented. But at the same time, if you flip that argument, it becomes an opportunity for governments, for communities, for indigenous organizations, for groups here in this country to respond on a site-specific scale.
When we talk about remote areas, those have very unique problems, but then there's also terrific problems with drinking water in urban environments as well. Are you focusing on that? Because I know, for example, a tremendous amount of water is being just totally wasted because a lot of the infrastructure, the piping that was put in 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago is deteriorating, and there's tremendous water leakage that way. Are you addressing those issues as well?
You're absolutely right, and there's a wonderful organization here in Washington, D.C., called the International Housing Coalition, IHC, and they are very concerned, particularly with urban and peri-urban, the slums that are on the edges of mega cities around the world. The statistics, I think this last year, half the world now lives in urban areas, and the momentum is towards that. So that's a huge problem of working to reduce the amount of leaks, to improve the water supply so it's more dependable, so that it's not just on for 2 hours every 2 days. And that's, again, part of the puzzle. I mentioned a few minutes ago the need for a balanced approach. Problems are not just in sub-Saharan Africa, but it's also Latin America and Southeast Asia. And in the same way, it's a rural problem, it's a peri-urban problem, and it's an urban problem. And one of the beauties of a law that was passed 2 years ago by Congress called the Senator Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act. It was named after the late Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, and it was a bipartisan act that for the first time puts clean drinking water and sanitation at the center of U.S. foreign developmental aid. And in that act, they have a very balanced approach to the need for the United States, for USAID, for example, our developmental arm of the government, to focus on rural, urban, and peri-urban areas in a balanced way.
Mm-hmm. I'm in San Diego, and of course, just south of us is Tijuana, that about 70% of all the water that's put into the system is just lost because of poor plumbing. Sure. Tremendous waste.
Sobering.
Everyone's hearing about global warming. We hear a lot about that, and certainly the issue of clean water is an enormous challenge. How was global warming affecting your mission and your sense of urgency?
Well, it's a very timely question, obviously, and when you think about what climate change is, it really gets back to the type of impacts, and probably half the type of impacts people are worried about relate to water. So it will be a huge issue with each passing year. I mean, it's not just drinking water, of course, but on the whole issue of droughts, and floods, and receding glaciers, and the possibility of sea level rise, there are a lot of water impacts. Specifically with respect to drinking water, our focus has been to try to make the point, and it dovetails with a number of reports that have come out in recent years, is that the problem of access to safe drinking water will be exacerbated by climate change, without question. And I think we're seeing that in the next 2 to 4 years, water will reach, on most people's radar screens, the attention that was been accorded climate change in the last couple of years. We're just a few years away from people realizing the critical importance of water worldwide, and again, broader than just drinking water. But at the same time, I should mention that one of our concerns here is for people to understand as well that the problem will be, as I mentioned, exacerbated. It's going to be made worse, but the problem is here today as well.
Right. Good point.
In the next 24 hours, 5,000 children will die from diseases related to bad water and sanitation. Half the world's malnutrition is related to diarrheal dehydration caused by bad water and sanitation. So the problem, the house is on fire today, and that's the message that we don't want to get lost with, as much valid concern as there is and will be for climate change.
It's going to become an enormous issue, because one of the greatest challenges is the fact that the glaciers worldwide are receding and disappearing, and millions of people rely on that as their source of water. I don't have an answer to that. It's going to be something. I don't think anybody has an answer to that. Some people may have to literally just abandon areas because there is no water left. These are very challenging problems that we're facing in the future.
Your reference there a minute ago to abandoning areas is right, and it's also, I think it will be speeded up. It's also something that has been too long below the radar screen. The phrase was environmental refugees having to flee because the soil is played out or the aquifers have dropped. And several years ago, the UN did a study, and they realized that there were actually more people that have fled for environmental problems than for political problems. Oftentimes, it's not as, you know, you're not life and death, but they've actually been uprooted and had to leave. And there's a greater number of those than political refugees.
Now, there's a lot of suffering, not only just from the lack of water, but then as well the tensions that begin to develop between neighbors and regional communities in the developing areas that otherwise wouldn't be there.
Exactly, but at the same time, and it's a message that we've been urging as well, is so often through history, there's actually a surprisingly few number of points of warfare and friction fought over water. I mean, they're out there, of course, and that's happened, and you can see it every few months, you hear about something. But down through history, water has more often been a source of accord and treaty and compact and negotiation, because people have realized its absolute importance. I was just at a meeting today. I heard that there was a major university was going to host a conference on water and peace. Again, not water and war, but water and peace, with the idea that the conflict can stop at the water's edge.
David, that is I'd never heard that or thought about that. That is fascinating, and it makes absolute sense. It's a very interesting concept that when it gets down to that level of basic challenge amongst humans, that they finally decide it's time. We can't kill each other over this.
That's right.
We have to figure out a solution. That's very fascinating. Very, very fascinating.
And let's hope it's actually works that way.
Yes.
And I think if enough people can realize the importance of this issue, the U.S. can really be a leader in this field.
Well, all the more reason why advocacy is the cutting edge right now. People have to have this information and have alternatives and hope. David Douglas, who's with Water Advocates, is talking with us. He's going to be talking at the Environmental Film Festival, specifically March 22nd in the nation's capital on National Water Day. David, in terms of people, organizations, I know that you're reaching out to the faith-based communities. Give us some real hands-on on how they can contact you and how you can help them.
Yes. First of all, we'd be glad to redirect anyone who wants to contact here at wateradvocates.org. We have a list on our website of actual implementing organizations around the United States that are 501c3, in other words, that to which people can give tax-deductible contributions. And again, we don't want funding for ourselves. In addition to that, there are a number of organizations here in Washington that have ratcheted up their attention on clean drinking water in a very effective ways. There's a water working group that's been formed out of a coalition of faith-based organizations that's headquartered over at Church World Service, just across from the Supreme Court. Environmental groups such as the Natural Resources Defense Council has begun an initiative on behalf of international clean drinking water and sanitation. There's an association of implementing organizations, some of the finest organizations in the U.S., such as CARE and AfriCare and Water for People, have formed the first umbrella alliance of implementing organizations called the Millennium Water Alliance. MWA is the acronym. And also there's a new, somewhat unprecedented nonprofit called the Global Water Challenge. I think it's found at globalwaterchallenge.org. That's been getting off the ground for the last year or so. That was founded by the UN Foundation to focus on this issue. It's a coalition of foundations, corporations, nonprofits to focus on this issue. They're particularly looking at micro-enterprise opportunities through providing funding for safe drinking water and adequate sanitation in a sustainable way. And they're also looking at water and sanitation in schools worldwide, which is what I alluded to earlier in the conversation about the specific advantages that could come about through working with local communities to get clean drinking water and adequate latrines at schools.
About the best we can do right now is work real hard to make a difference, and certainly that's what Water Advocates is doing, and I wish you great success in the years ahead.
I've enjoyed talking with you on this, Sydney, and thanks so much for giving coverage to just an issue that's critical today and will get even more so.
Thanks, David.
Take good care.
Wishing you all a great spring day. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.